Welcome to the University of Limerick Research Impact Podcast Series. I'm your host, Professor Helena Lenihan, Chair of the University of Limerick's Research Impact Committee. The ethos of the Research Impact Programme at UL is to recognise and celebrate research excellence with impact. In that spirit, we established the President's Research Excellence and Impacts Awards. Today, I am joined by members of a team who are recipients of the inaugural Research Excellence and Impact Awards for outstanding research collaboration. This decade-long partnership between the University of Limerick and the Health Service Executive has benefited patients dealing with multi-drug-resistant infections, patients with cystic fibrosis, and those with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. Led by Professor Colm Dunn, Director of Research, University of Limerick School of Medicine, the collaboration involves a truly transdisciplinary team of microbiologists, designers, engineers, nurses, physiotherapists, pediatricians, and respiratory specialists. This really powerful collaboration involves strong links between UL and the UL Hospitals Group, as well as an array of collaborators in the UK, across Europe, and the United States. Without further ado, I would like to introduce my panel of speakers for today's podcast. With us today, we have Professor Colm Dunn, Foundation Chair and Director of Research at the School of Medicine at the University of Limerick. Professor Nuala O'Connell, Consultant Clinical Microbiologist, University Hospital Limerick. Professor Barry Lennan, Consultant Respiratory Pediatrician, University Hospital Limerick. Kevin O'Sullivan, Senior Research Fellow, the Rapid Innovation Unit, University of Limerick. And Barbara Slevin, the Assistant Director of Nursing, Infection Prevention and Control at the UL Hospitals Group. You're all very welcome to today's podcast. And first of all, I want to really congratulate each and every one of you. And we're really looking forward to this podcast today. So as to set the scene for our listeners, Barry, I might kick off with you by asking you to give us some insights into the challenges of dealing with infections for patients with respiratory conditions.
Yeah, thanks, Helena. Well, respiratory tract infections are probably the main reason for the general population attending primary care, whether that's their GP or the emergency department. And it certainly would be one of the leading causes of admissions to the hospital. And that's particularly true for pediatrics. The impact of respiratory tract infections is greater for those with an underlying respiratory condition, whether that's COPD or asthma, they're relatively common conditions, or some of the rarer conditions like cystic fibrosis. And that's a particular area that I would have an expertise in, and it's one of the strengths of this group that we were able to focus on that particular cohort. Most respiratory illnesses in the general population are viral in origin. However, in cystic fibrosis, bacteria are a major problem. And that then leads to several different challenges. Certainly, infection control is something that we've focused very much on. And that's really focused a lot on limiting the risk of cross-infection. That might be from other patients with cystic fibrosis, from other patients who don't have cystic fibrosis, or from the general population. And actually, as part of our research, we've found that there are also potential risks in the devices that patients use every day to aid their airway clearance. So a major part then of what we do is surveillance and surveillance of airway samples, whether that's a cough swab, a sputum sample, a bronchoalveolar lavage sample. We do these regularly in our patients with cystic fibrosis, trying to detect these bacteria that can have such a detrimental effect, because there's a sense that if we can detect them early, we do have effective treatments, typically with antibiotics, and the outcome is very good when we do this. So that's then kind of, if you like, then the third aspect of this, which is really getting a good airway sample and getting it to the lab and getting it to Nuala and her team. Because we need to culture the organisms. And then we need to go to the next step, which is that we need to assess what antibiotics those particular organisms are sensitive to, because based on that, then we can target our treatment effectively.
That's really interesting. Thanks very much, Barry. So, Cullum, at UL, at the core of our mission in UL is to try to address research grant challenges. I'm interested to know, how did this partnership come about to tackle this grand challenge?
Our work together as a group, as a collaborative group over the last 10 years has very much had patients at its center. And we focused on trying to develop a better understanding of infectious disease, particularly infections that patients might acquire while they're in hospital. We've looked particularly at multi-drug resistance and infection prevention. And in order to do that, our team has involved experienced researchers and also those at the very beginning of their career. And it's resulted in both improved infection for those in hospital and new innovations, including medical devices. But in order to do that, we had to recognize very early in the life of the medical school in particular that we had to make ourselves known to clinical colleagues. So just over 10 years ago, when we began to develop research plans for the new medical school in Limerick, I visited our biggest clinical partner, which was the hospital in Dura-Doyle. And as you know, Helena, I wouldn't be slow coming forward. And I essentially knocked on doors and went about trying to persuade people within the hospital that the university, the medical school, and I suppose I myself would be able to be a resource that they could access to move forward their plans and their search for solutions that they were meeting on a day-to-day basis within the hospital. And our initial focus was on infections that patients sometimes pick up in the hospital, that, as Barry mentioned, and as Nuala and Barbara will deal with. And it's a problem that's global, along with antimicrobial resistance and the ability of bacteria and fungi to overcome the drugs that we currently have available. What we've done since then has been very much grounded in the reality of real-world problems, rather than looking at the molecular traits associated with gene transfer and antibiotic resistance. We've instead focused on the patient journey, the reality of infections and infectious disease outbreaks, trying to develop a better understanding of those, and through that understanding, to then come up with solutions that we can hopefully implement on the ground in reality. And through that work, we've also focused on medical devices that are part of the solution that allow us to benefit those patients who are at risk within the hospital setting.
Colin, you picked up a very interesting issue there, and I'll turn to Nuala now in a moment to pick up on this. You clearly outlined this notion of the rigor of research. And now with you, Nuala, I'd like to pick up really on the point about it's not good enough just to have rigor, but we need to see how that rigorous research translates into relevance. And Cullum discussed this notion of infections in hospital and how all of this plays out in the real world. So Nuala, I think all of us and all of the listeners, I think we're now more acutely aware than ever of the issue of dealing with infection control in the hospital setting. So Nuala, I'd like to ask you to address the question of how has the research, this whole research agenda, as alluded to there by Cullum, how has this helped in reality?
Thank you, Helena, for the question. It was great when the medical school opened and Cullum came knocking on the door, because as he already alluded to, we were dealing with real life issues. Coming into hospital is a risky business for patients, and invariably, when one comes into a hospital with some infrastructural challenges, we occasionally have outbreaks, particularly of multi-drug resistant organisms. So Cullum has afforded us the opportunity to study the impact of these outbreaks on patient morbidity and mortality and share any lessons we've learned from these outbreaks. So as a consequence of outbreaks such as we've had extended spectrum beta-lactamase outbreaks in our neonatal unit, for example, or more commonly, we have an ongoing issue with a particular superbug called CPE in University of Hospital Limerick group, we're able to study what the contributing factors are to the outbreak and understand the role of the environment in particular, the role of hand hygiene, overcrowded wards, the new developments with single rooms that are coming on stream, how all of these will contribute to abating an outbreak and preventing patients ultimately from acquiring nosocomial infection. Because the premise of all of us who work in healthcare is to ensure that patients are nursed and managed in a clean and safe environment. So every bit of research we do underpins our aspiration to deliver upon this.
Really interesting, Nuala. And Barbara, if I can turn to you now. Nuala mentioned this point of the role of hand hygiene, which is something we're all hearing about all of the time now more than ever again. But my understanding, Barbara, is that your role is specifically focused on dealing with infection prevention and control. So with the whole COVID-19 COVID pandemic, is the message of clean hands save lives, is that finally getting out there?
Yes, I believe that it is. And we know that hand hygiene has a major global impact and has been led out on by the World Health Organization. The Clean Hands Save Lives global annual campaign, which was launched in 2009, has continued throughout these years. And central to that really is ensuring that healthcare workers clean their hands at the right time and in the right way. Certainly from an infection control perspective, we know that hand hygiene is the simplest and it is the most effective action that any healthcare worker can take to reduce the spread of pathogens and prevent infections, particularly in the healthcare setting. And that includes COVID-19. And I would say that certainly from our perspective here in the hospital, hand hygiene has a significant impact on reducing other healthcare associated infections, as we've mentioned earlier, CPE. So it's important really that hand hygiene is underpinning education and training at all levels throughout the organization, through all disciplines, and that every healthcare worker really has the knowledge and the skills needed to perform hand hygiene appropriately. And it's such an important aspect of their job in preventing infection spread. I believe that it's been very positive because throughout our experience this year during COVID, hand hygiene training has formed the core aspect of our training and education when we've been teaching staff the importance of donning and doffing their PPE correctly and ensuring that they are safe and protected during this pandemic. Coupled with that, social influence is really important in encouraging hand hygiene. And, you know, I strongly believe that we all have a role to play in gently nudging our healthcare colleagues to perform their hand hygiene at the right time. And certainly we would espouse, you know, the importance of having positive role modelling, particularly by our senior leaders in the organisation as well. With an outbreak such as COVID, it always provides an opportunity to improve things. And we did this by having hand gel more readily accessible in areas that we wouldn't have had previously, like reception areas and classrooms, coffee rooms, anywhere really. And that's feeding the importance of making sure that people are doing it when they need to. And certainly when removing their masks, you know, for their coffee breaks. So we have pocket bottles readily available as well for the staff. With the public, however, I think it's really, really positive. And certainly from where I'm standing in an infection control role, I'm really excited by this because hand gel is now ubiquitous. You can't walk into a shop or school without having it available. And I believe that the media has played a very positive role as well in ensuring that the public know the importance of hand hygiene. We mentioned about innovation and technology as well, and that's really important. And from an infection control point of view, we ensure that we have good, positive front of house messaging around hand hygiene at all the entrance and exit points to our hospital. We developed new hand hygiene stations, and that leads to positive reinforced messaging and positive reinforcement. I would also just say that the caveat is the whole sustainability of hand hygiene, because we know very much it's behavior driven. And in studying hand hygiene, it's important to look at the behavioral aspects of why people actually clean their hands at the right time and for the right reasons. Certainly, there's nothing like an outbreak or a pandemic to increase one's adherence to hand hygiene, because it's linked with the risk to the person. So I think it will be interesting to see going into the future how hand hygiene will be sustained. And I think we have to constantly reinforce with gentle nudging and positive reinforcement into the future.
Thanks, Barbara. Colm, would you like to pick up on some of those points?
To follow on from what Barbara has said there, well before COVID emerged as a global threat, as a group, we've been working on hand hygiene and behavioral aspects of that. And it's really interesting because we looked at medical students, nursing students, and allied health students, physiotherapists, etc. And while they're in college, they're tremendously aware of the importance of hand hygiene. And it is when they go into practice and as they become more experienced in the clinical setting that the bad habits start to become embedded as they become more socialized in working with clinical colleagues. And as Barbara said, even though we're now very aware of hand hygiene and alcohol gels are ubiquitous, once the vaccinations start to become more commonplace and the threat, the imminent threat of illness associated with COVID-19 starts to diminish, whether the good behaviors around hand hygiene that have been implemented within the hospitals continue, because it is more likely that they will continue amongst medical professionals than it will amongst the general public as the threat starts to diminish. But there's no guarantee that that'll be the case.
That's really interesting. I mean, we would hope that these behavioural changes would be long lasting. I can't help but think of this notion of never waste a good crisis. But the notion is to keep these behavioural changes post-crisis. Barbara, you mentioned this very interesting notion, which I'd like to pick up with you on, Kevin, about the role of innovation and technology. And I understand that you were involved in the development of what was an award-winning medical device as part of this larger collaboration with some of the collaborators here today. So first off, congratulations on that. But secondly, I'd like to really know about what was the product and also what benefits it had for patients on the ground.
Thank you very much. I suppose I'm relatively new to the group. I'm only involved about 5.5-6 years. So in the device side of things, we, as Barry and Colm mentioned earlier, and the devices, specifically the airway clearance devices, is something that's ubiquitous and very important to particularly patients with CF in maintaining their airway function and their health, and to prevent infection in the respiratory tract causing further issues. So the device we worked on was it's called an oscillating positive expiratory pressure device, or an OPEP for short. And this, the entire project, the SoloPEP project, came about from observations made by Barry and by Colm in clinic as to one of the pediatric patients who had discoloration in one of their respiratory devices. And when that was tested, it turned out to be multifilia. And this is something you know, certainly don't want hanging around in the medical devices of children with cystic fibrosis. So I think very early on, they realized that the almost an obvious answer to this, rather than disinfecting and cleaning every single day or every single use in some cases when they use these devices, that if we could come up with a disposable version that provided the same performance, that would get around an awful lot of microbiological issues. So I suppose that was the kind of kernel of the idea. I came from my side, which is industrial design with a strong background in med tech. And we went through the iterative process and came up with an idea and that seemed to work very well, and that led us on to securing Enterprise Ireland funding to develop the idea. And that was over the course of 2-3 years, where we did a significant amount of development work and were able to also trial it at a large scale through the hospital with, you know, 50 CF patients over the course of a month using this, and had fantastic results in it. So it really was kind of demonstrated the best of the collaboration, what you can do when you bring the different disciplines together to, I suppose, see the clinical need, know what skill set was required to translate that clinical need into an end product that would actually benefit the patients. And it's been a fantastic journey over the last 5 years, particularly the reception from the patients and from their parents, who at the end of the day, I suppose, are most conscious of the long-term outcomes and the long-term effects that an infection can have in this cohort. So it's been a fantastic experience over the last 5 years, facilitated by Professor Dunn, to make the initial contact.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So, Cullum, what are the next steps here? I mean, has it been fully rolled out, or what are the next steps?
The journey in developing the OPEP device, as Kevin said, began with an observation of a real need for patients. And over the 4 years, supported by Enterprise Ireland, we've been able to develop a product, design a product. We've patented that product. We've brought it through very rigorously monitored clinical studies with the help of the respiratory physicians and the team, Barry and his team within the hospital group, and also working with the microbiology team to assess the impact of the devices in terms of their cleanliness and reduction of risk for infection. The patenting of the devices led to us deciding that we wanted to spin out a business from the university. And with the help of the technology transfer office and the research office within the university, we were able to do that. And the launch of that small business led to the award given to us by Enterprise Ireland about 24 months ago as being a big idea and one of the small spin-out companies within Ireland that had the potential to become something bigger. And I suppose, you know, every cloud has a silver lining. And with the emergence of COVID-19 as a respiratory illness, a new focus was placed on the idea of devices that didn't need cleaning and would reduce the risk for patients within hospital who might, for example, have COVID and be potential reservoirs, if you like, of COVID and therefore a danger for both other patients around them, but also clinical staff. And so our little company became the focus of some attention, and we sold the business during the summer this year. And there's a very large multinational business that is going to take this Irish innovation and use it to develop an Irish business that will reach further globally and make the product available as part of their portfolio in 2021. For us, it was a huge success because not only did we get to go through a scientific project that had a real clinical relevance, but we have the ultimate reward of seeing a product that's going to be on the shelves that came literally start to finish from Limerick.
That's really interesting, the way you've gone through the whole kind of innovation value chain from start to finish and hopefully had lots of learnings along the way, no doubt. So congratulations again, Kevin, because I know that's a key part of your work as well. I think lots of what we've been discussing today, at the heart of it is this notion of building teams. And in research, we talk about all these things like interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, transdisciplinary work. But at the end of the day, it's about usually tackling a problem or a grand challenge by a team. So Cullum, if I can stick with this notion here about building teams, what have you learned from this specific collaboration and working with the collaborators, some of whom we're here today, others who are, as I said at the beginning, elsewhere in Ireland, in the UK, in the US, in Europe, and I know you're part of a bigger cost European Commission network as well. But for our listeners today who are listening in on this notion of excellent research with impact, I think we'd all be interested in hearing, what have you learned from this collaboration in terms of building strong research teams?
First of all, I think it's absolutely appropriate to acknowledge the fact that this award reflects the work of a very large team. It's people who are based in the University of Limerick, other people within Ireland, particularly the HSE, and especially our colleagues in University Hospital Limerick, and other friends and colleagues who we've worked with over the last 10 years across the UK, Europe, and the US. There's the old adage, which is you know, to ensure success, you surround yourself by the best people you can. And I'm not being even vaguely trite or superficial in saying that we've been very lucky as a team. We're very like-minded. That's not to say there's groupthink. There's a tremendous sense of realism and practicality across the team. But everybody involved, I think without exception, sees challenges rather than barriers, and they see opportunities rather than problems. And that means that when we do come together to look at a new aspect of our research, we do genuinely do it with a very pragmatic sense of saying, do we have the resources to do this? If we don't have the resources, do we know somebody who does? And we have been very quick to reach out to other groups that have resources that we don't have. We've been able to work with technologies that are absolutely new in Ireland. Barry, for example, works with an Exelizer breath monitoring system that is pretty much unique within the country. We've been able to look at developing insights into issues only because we've come together as people who have different qualifications, different skill sets, different interests. And we've also killed projects very early. Kevin and will remember very clearly meetings that we've had where we've looked at potential opportunities and have said that either we don't have the capacity to deal with them, or maybe we don't have the skill sets, or maybe we just are too busy and need to focus our attention on things that we can achieve rather than having pet projects that consume a lot of our energy and effort but may not come to anything. And for us, it's been about staying very grounded in real world problems, making sure, as I say, that the patients were very much at the center of everything what we're doing. And we also wanted our work to be relevant internationally, not just Ireland. And that has meant bringing perspectives from people, as you mentioned, the EU cost action, people who have a different way of working in a different geography, but yet we find ourselves looking at the same problems and trying to come up with a solution that's relevant to all of us.
That's really interesting. Nuala, you're working obviously in a hospital environment, and Cullum has spoken about, you know, the importance of bringing different perspectives to different problems. I'm curious to know, as I'm sure our listeners are, does interdisciplinary collaboration, does it come as natural in a hospital environment as it does, let's say, in a more academic environment?
Well, care of the patient in a clinical environment is holistic in nature. So it involves a multitude of different healthcare professionals. So we have nursing staff, medical staff, ancillary staff such as radiologists and radiographers, scientists in the laboratory doing the diagnostic tests, physios, speech and language therapists, etc. So all of us, by nature of being a healthcare worker, have an underlying curiosity about how the body heals itself. And invariably with that, when you have a novel clinical scenario, or in my case, as a microbiologist with an interest in infection control, a cluster of unusual infections, for example, that curiosity is obviously stemmed by doing research or investigation as to why something is happening. And a lot of us as healthcare workers are quite ambitious. So if you've got a young, ambitious nurse or doctor, the curiosity lends to formalized curiosity, such as one can call research. And now that we have this wonderful collaboration set up with the Health Sciences Academy at UL, and since the medical school was born and Prof Dunn came knocking on my door, and we've been able to engage in this research to, as Cullum has already alluded to, in a very practical way, because at the essence of everything we do is patient care. And even the patient themselves are an important stakeholder in research. And we've actually published on our patient-centered care by listening to the voice of the patient to improve patients' experiences, particularly in the setting of this superbug we have called CPE, to listen to them as to how we can improve their management in the hospital, because we learned from speaking with them that they oftentimes felt isolated. And they could tell us their opinions on hand hygiene and environmental hygiene. So we were able thereafter to improve their clinical management. And that in itself has lent to some research outputs. So I think it does, the clinical environment does foster an interest in research. And as I say, with an academic partner, that has come to fruition, because one of the rate limiting steps with research in the clinical environment is time.
Thanks very much, Nuala. Barry, you might like to pick up on some of that, please.
Yeah, just to follow on from what Nuala said, I think Nuala's absolutely right. Within the clinical environment, I suppose we tend to use the term multidisciplinary teams or MDTs, and that comes very naturally, I think, within the clinical environment, whether it's, you know, a complex patient who needs respiratory, cardiac, endocrinology involved, and then all the nursing and allied health people and physicians, surgeons who have to come together to look after patients at different levels, depending on the different level of complexity. What doesn't come, I think, quite so naturally is interdisciplinary collaboration when it comes to research. That is more challenging, and it's challenging in the clinical environment, and it's challenging in the Irish clinical environment in particular, because we are so service heavy. There isn't a huge amount of wiggle room for research. And that's really when somebody like Professor Colm Dunn comes in, and really you need somebody like this to make these things happen. I mean, Colm has many attributes, but one I would say is a major one is that he's a key connector. And this whole collaboration is based on that. So I never would have met, you know, Kevin O'Sullivan, who's in the Rapid Innovation Unit, because I never knew it existed. But Colm did. And actually, Colm went to that team with our problem. And equally linking in with Nuala and the microbiology team, Colm has a very strong background in microbiology. And then also has a strong link back into industry, if you look at his own pathway career. So sometimes you get lucky and you find somebody who gels it and brings it all together. And I think that's what's the strength of this particular, in I suppose, collaboration. And I think that's what I suppose I'd like to see us developing and moving forward, that kind of collaboration where you link people together who don't naturally necessarily link together, and you really do seem to come up with something that's innovative and new and exciting, because you're learning from people who you've never met before or never spoken to before. I find it always fascinating talking to Kevin, because he works in a world that's so different from the world I work in, and yet in this particular collaboration, we work hand in glove. It's remarkable how well we work together. Every time we meet, we come up with more ideas. The problem, as Colm was saying, was trying to bring those back and to get real and to, you know, to get back on focus. So that would be the point I'd make on that particular question.
Thanks very much, Barry. Listening to you all here today, a couple of things strike me. First of all, this notion of, I think it's a really fantastic example of innovation occurring at the kind of boundaries or the margins of all your disciplines and the different perspectives you bring. The other thing is, Nuala brought up this word holistic. What strikes me without a doubt is that in the case of this collaboration, the whole is definitely greater than the sum of the parts. And I think that's just something that strikes me listening to you all here today. I might stick with you a little bit, Barry, and come back to this COVID-19 issue, which we are all talking about all of the time and all concerned with. I think regardless of what discipline you come from, COVID-19 has had a major impact on our medical system and indeed the type of research programs that we're involved in. But I am curious, as a non-medical person, I'm just curious from a research perspective, do you see this as continuing to affect research activity in the clinical setting?
Well, I suppose the place to start is does it currently have an impact? And it certainly has. And the major impact really is trying to ensure the safety of staff and patients in a working environment that has always been challenging, but it's been almost turned on its head with the challenge of COVID-19. And while we've had to realign the entire healthcare system, and particularly, you know, I suppose we've seen that locally at UHL, to really face the COVID-19 crisis front on, we've still had to try to keep all the other services going. And that's been the major challenge. And if you try then to put in a research program in alongside that as well, in all the list of priorities and challenges that you have, it does become challenging. And I think there's no doubt that research has been negatively impacted by the COVID-19 crisis, but we have managed to continue to be involved in clinical trials, in observational studies, in innovative studies and programs like this particular one. So the challenge going forward, I think, as well as trying to do things in a different way, whether that's smaller numbers of patients attending hospital, making sure that they can come in a way that's safe and interact with our staff, that's safe for both staff and patients. Bringing in novel approaches, which might be remote monitoring. There's been software and hardware around for some time, but this has really pushed us into really grasping that as a modality of looking after patients. And that equally has an implication for how we do research in with patients. Going forward, as we know, there's a lot of talk this week in particular about the vaccination program. That's undoubtedly going to have a positive impact, but going to take a little bit of time to roll out over the coming weeks and months. And then we have the natural kind of seasonality. The winter is probably another 3 months. I always consider the viral winter to be really till the end of March. And we saw from around that time on, as we got into the spring and summer, certainly 2020, the COVID-19 burden did seem to drop for a whole host of reasons. We were locked down at the time, but I'm sure there's some seasonality having an impact on that as well. And then that's going to open up things again. And so we're hoping to get our research and our clinical practice back online during that. So the biggest challenge right now is the uncertainty. It's for the last, 9 months or so now, it's been difficult to plan 2 to 6 weeks ahead. So it's virtually impossible to plan 6 months ahead. And as you know, pretty much all clinical-based research does need to plan that far ahead, at least. You're usually planning 12 to 18 months ahead. So the uncertainty that remains in that kind of time frame persists. And I think that's the greatest challenge that we have.
Thanks, Barry. Barbara, clearly there's a lot of uncertainty for the broader public as well. And I'm not going to get in with you about a debate about COVID-19 and the pros and cons of vaccines and those contentious issues. But one thing I'm very interested to hear your view on is the importance of informing the public on the benefits of vaccines in general. Could you maybe share with us some of your insights around that issue, please, Barbara?
We all know that vaccinations are an important part of public health, and disease prevention really is the key to public health. I think as healthcare professionals, we all know that it's so much better to prevent the disease than to treat it where possible. And that is really where vaccination is so important to all of us. Vaccines, as we know, prevent disease to the people who receive them. And in doing so, it protects other people who come into contact with unvaccinated people. And essentially, it saves lives. And, many of the dangerous infections and infectious diseases have been prevented in such a simple and effective way. And we can see the legacy of that with polio and the HPV, probably more recently, and measles, and, over the last number of years, from an infection control point of view, we've dealt with some measles outbreaks. So we can see how having an unvaccinated population can lead to such an impact, even within the hospital setting. Vaccination after clean water was one of the most important discoveries of the modern world. And today it's timely that we're discussing this, because today is D-Day, the vaccination rollout in the UK. And I was driving in my car this morning and I heard a report on the radio about a 90-year-old lady, Irish lady actually, in the UK, who received her vaccination this morning. And I thought her message was very significant and it was very positive. And I thought it was really important to share that really with the public. And, that she had no fear, obviously, maybe at 90 years of age, and perhaps maybe that has had something to do with it. But no, I think it was interesting to hear her experience of it and leading out on such an important initiative, which we all promote very much from an infection control perspective throughout our careers. My role in infection control essentially is about advising staff on the importance of vaccination uptake. And certainly year on year, we are shoulder to the wheel, the infection control team here, promoting flu vaccination, because we know the impact a flu outbreak can have on the day-to-day running of our hospital and our organisation. I'm excited by the innovations that have taken place so quickly and so swiftly. We know that vaccine development can take a significant period of time. I think in around 4 years is probably the shortest time frame that we look at. And yet here we are in the midst of a pandemic and our vaccination is ready for rollout. And it's incredible to think this has happened so quickly and at such a fast pace. I'd be interested from an infection control perspective to see how this is going to impact and, you know, what the uptake of vaccination will be, because essentially as healthcare workers, we have, and I alluded to this earlier in hand hygiene, we also have a very important role in positive role modelling regarding flu vaccination uptake and now with COVID vaccination uptake as well. And it's interesting really to be at the close of a year and the beginning of a new one to see how this will shape the direction globally, nationally and locally as we enter this new direction and deal with this new COVID reality and see what impact this is actually going to have for us. And certainly from the lessons learned of the last pandemic, the Spanish flu, we're in a much different position now to see where this is going to take us in the future. So interesting times ahead, certainly.
That's fascinating, Barbara. I think we could have a whole podcast on the issues you've been discussing there. I might return to you, Kevin, and another set of words that I've kind of been popping up of late that we're hearing about is this notion of 3D printing. And I know this is something you know a lot about, so I'd like to ask you something about this. From what I understand, it's a relatively new technology, but it's got massive potential to disrupt the way we do things in lots of sectors throughout our economies and societies more broadly. Could you maybe give us some insights into the potential of 3D printing in a medical setting, please, Kevin?
Absolutely. I think in the context of the medical setting, 3D printing has the potential to completely disrupt things and fundamentally change things in a way that probably hasn't been seen since people started understanding about infection control and that germs cause issues when they're doing surgery. I think this is another great example to follow on a point Barry had earlier of the, I suppose, almost the matchmaking that Cullum has done between the various collaborators. A prime example of how 3D printing can be used to really impact the lives of patients is some work that was done on the back of that introduction. One of a patient of Barry's that had a feeding tube that had a tear in it and was unsuitable to have the feeding tube replaced. And this had been managed for a number of weeks by the nursing staff with, you know, adhesive tape, which is not a great solution, particularly in these kids that have enough wrong with them already and have enough struggles. So the advantage of 3D printing was we were able to turn around a device overnight that was able to seal the hole in the feeding tube and allow the child to resume their normal feeding regime. And that has allowed, I suppose, a number of patients in the interim. It's a very niche problem that there isn't an off-the-shelf solution for. And when you contact the companies that make these feeding tubes initially, their answer is just replace it, which would normally be the standard of care. But in this cohort of patients, it can be so dangerous for them to go in and have an extra procedure and an extra anaesthetic that if we can do something using 3D printing, then it really opens a whole new, I suppose, field of treatment options, personalized medicine is something that's been talked about for a number of years from the drug side of things. But certainly that's moving more towards now. We look at it as an ability to do personalized medicine with devices. So we can make bespoke, patient-specific devices and treat things that are or provide solutions for the likes of Barry to treat patients where there is no solution off the peg. And this is something, you know, we have materials now that are sterilizable, they're implantable, they can be, you know, used in various different areas. It's incredibly exciting time, I suppose, as an industrial designer and from my background and what I'm interested in, the ability to go from nothing to a fully finished device ready to go on a patient in a number of hours is something that's incredibly exciting and something incredibly rewarding. And it really does speak testament to the collaboration again. I mean, the work we did initially on that one feeding tube with that one patient has led to a number of other sites and physicians and patients around the country and further afield that again have this very niche specific problem but for which there is no answer. So it's really, really rewarding, particularly in the case of some of the patients we've dealt with where this really has served as a bridge to surgery or as a kind of a lifeline for some of these feeding tubes to keep them in place until they were clinically well enough to have it replaced. So the potential in medicine is absolutely tremendous. And as part of the Rapid Innovation Unit, we have a world-class suite of equipment now. That those links, again, not to hark on about the collaboration, but Barry and Nuala and Cullen have issues and have these problems and maybe not the means to solve them, whereas we have all of the knowledge and equipment meant to solve these problems, we don't know what they are. So that's the glorious thing about this collaboration, is that these two halves are coming together with, again, I think as Newland and Barbara said earlier, you know, everybody is in this to help patients. There's nobody sitting around this discussion that isn't here for the same reason. So I think the potential for that really does open up in a huge amount of doors going forward, and it's something that's going to be fundamental part of medicine for the future, really.
You're after stopping at the ideal point there, Kevin, in terms of looking to the future. What struck me today is that you have and are experiencing a really good collaboration. But Cullum, if I can address my final question to you, and then anybody else who wants to come in on this, please feel free to do so. Two parts to this question really is, where do you see the collaboration going from here? And what are the other new challenges you're likely to take on as part of this collaboration?
I think the first thing that has to be said is that this is an ongoing collaboration, even though the award that we have is in recognition of 10 years of work together. We haven't gone our own separate ways. And as a group of friends and researchers and colleagues, we're still focused on developing new projects and new insights and making a difference. So it's a continuation. COVID is an interesting development because it has accelerated some things within Ireland that would otherwise have taken an awful long time to happen. We now have a National Ethics Committee for Clinical Research that was headed by Professor Mary Horgan in Cork. And that has very much changed the landscape in terms of how clinical and medical research is governed. And that will be of tremendous benefit to any of us who are interested in this area. We also have Minister Simon Harris and colleagues in Northern Ireland looking at the potential development of a national infectious disease initiative. And we have the development of new biobanking initiatives that are being supported by the HRB and other funding agencies. And all of these things are going to change the way that we do research and the resources that are available to us. And they will, I think, by definition, bring groups together nationally that may not otherwise have met each other or have known of each other's skill sets and expertise. The other thing that COVID has done is that it has masked existing problems. What I mean by that is that when COVID had an impact on hospitals, it meant that certain elective procedures were postponed and it reduced the amount of patient traffic through the facilities. And because of that, we would have seen a reduction in the incidence of our hospital-acquired infection for bacteria and fungi. But that doesn't mean that the problem has gone away. It simply means that the numbers of patients involved have reduced, and correspondingly, the levels of prevalence of those bacterial infections has reduced. As we see COVID becoming something that is manageable, hopefully, we are going to see that increase in clinical activity, and we will see the reemergence of those bacterial infections as a problem. And so we are focused as a team on ensuring that we take the opportunity and this break in the intensity of that problem to look at how we can put interventions in place to protect patients and reduce those risks. And we are doing that separately as a group. Kevin, Professor Leonard O'Sullivan of the Rapid Innovation Unit, and I are also looking at new medical devices that are focused on surgery and infection prevention in surgical theatres. And we're also looking at diagnostics, because now that we know what problems exist and have a better understanding of how those are characterized using molecular techniques, we are finding ways now to detect those bacteria, those infections, and to find ways to ameliorate their effect on the patient. So I think there's a lot of changes at the national level, and clearly as a group here, we are re-emphasizing some of the problems that we maybe discarded earlier on when this grouping was starting to emerge. And now we find that we have some bandwidth to go back and revisit those with new knowledge and new technology and the energy now to go and look at those again.
From what we've heard today, I think it's true to say that collectively and in a truly collaborative fashion, this team has delivered research findings that would not have been possible except for their shared aspirations, multidisciplinary knowledge and resources. It is in forging partnerships such as this where real innovation will be found. And the University of Limerick and its partners in the Health Service Executive are at the very forefront of this nexus of discovery with real impact. I would like to thank my panelists, Barbara Slevin, Barry Lennan and Nuala O'Connell from the UL Hospitals Group, Cullum Dunn, School of Medicine, UL, and Kevin O'Sullivan, the Rapid Innovation Unit, also at the University of Limerick. It's been a truly great pleasure speaking with all of you today. You have been listening to members of the President's Research Excellence and Impact 2020 Outstanding Research Collaboration Team, involving, amongst many others, the University of Limerick and the UL Hospitals Group. This research is supporting the UN Sustainable Development Goal of good health and well-being. This research is supported by Science Foundation Ireland, Enterprise Ireland, the Health Research Board, the European Commission, the National Children's Research Centre, Cystic Fibrosis Ireland, and TLC for CF. If you would like to find out more about research impact at the University of Limerick, please go to our website, ul.ie/researchimpact.